Back again to Zechariah chapter 12. Last week we began by looking at the statement at the very beginning of chapter 12 that introduced us to who God is, and therefore because of who God is, what God is able to do. And to start out by saying, this is the word of the Lord, again, Devar Adonai, the word of Yahweh, concerning Israel. Declares the Lord, and here the one who is, and we have participles here where those, we've circled those, the one who is stretching out the heavens, the one who is laying the foundation of the earth, the one who is forming the spirit of man within him. And by being a present continuous tense of the participles, emphasizing not something God did, but something God is and does on an ongoing basis. God is the one, if you will, the comparable statement to this is Hebrews 1, where he holds all things by the word of his power. So it is because of who God is that all the stated in chapter 12 that God is able to do. And we saw that he is going to make Israel like a fire pot, verse 6, among pieces of wood, and like a flaming torch among sheaves. And he's going to use them to, again, bring about the physical salvation of Israel. But what's more important, the physical salvation of verses 1 through 9, is the spiritual salvation in verses 10 through 14. Look at that just briefly as we work our way into chapter 13 this evening. And I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication. Now, it is interesting because as you look at this statement that is found here, you recognize that it is God who is going to bring Israel to the place of understanding their sin. And so it is God who is going to do it. It isn't that there all of a sudden this is going to happen. God is going to pour out. And by the way, go back with me because don't miss. Go back with me to verse 7, the house of David, the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Notice again in verse 8, the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the house of David in reverse order because the reason for that, by the way, as we saw, there's God's going to bring equality and he's going to deal with those in the outskirts before he deals with the house of David to show everybody that there's equality with God and one does not get preference over another. But having seen the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, you come down again to verse 10 and see the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And as we come to chapter 13, verse 1, you see again the house of David, verse 1, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So everywhere you look, that is, you can't miss. That's a focal point of what God's going to do. So God is going to pour out upon them the spirit of grace and supplication. And so that they will look on him whom they have pierced. And this is significant again because as he looks at this from the highest to the lowest, there is going to be this work of God's grace. And again, that's why the statement, if you go back again to chapter 12, where it says in verse 8, he will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, verse 8, and then he will do the house of David because he's starting from the least to the greater. And in this case, he then includes both of them in verse 10 to say it's going to be everybody. Nobody is going to be excluded in the work of God's grace. So notice what's happening. He's going to pour out the spirit of grace and supplication so they will look on him whom they have pierced. There are those who, looking at this section, that have tried to make this be something different, but it cannot be. The word means to pierce, to thrust through with a lance or a spear. And basically, thus, we find this. This is the climax of Jesus' death on Calvary, and significant that we should be covering this just before we come into this Easter season. So as you look at this, you understand that what we're talking about here is the ultimate point of their dealing with Jesus physically to bring about his death. And so they're going to look on him whom they have pierced. They will mourn for him. Now, it is interesting as you look at this mourning, there are several things that show the intensity of the mourning that takes place here. First of all, the word. The word that is used here for mourning over him is a word that has the idea, carries with it a very emotional thing, the smiting of the breast in the process. So this is not just, as we might do, some tears that we shed. This is a very visible, physical one. But notice, he even describes it further. Not only is it by the word that is used for mourning, but the description is one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. Now, again, he describes it from that standpoint. In other words, it's going to be intense, weeping and mourning and repenting in those days. By the nature of the term, by the nature of the description of that term that is given here, as one mourns for an only son, as one mourns over the loss of a firstborn child. By the way, in that day, firstborn far more crucial to them than it is to us. We have sought to bring more equality to the mix, but for them it wasn't. And again, I remind you, that is, just as an aside, you remember when Elisha is standing with Elijah, and he says, I want a double portion of your spirit. And like I say, some have gone from that and said, well, what, if you look at that, Elisha did twice as many miracles as Elijah. That's not the point at all. The double portion is that which was given to the firstborn. And so, as you remember, they were walking toward the time when Elijah's caught up. And there were a lot of them, the school of the prophets, who were following. And for some reason, Elisha's been singled out from the rest of them. And when they get to the Jordan, he's told, you know, you can stay here. He says, no, I'm going to go with you. And so the prophets watch as he opens up the waters. They cross the other side. And then he comes back and does the same miracle with the same garment. It is interesting because he got from Elijah what Elijah wanted. Elijah said, there are all these other prophets. I want to be the one that's the heir to the ministry that you are doing. That's the statement. So anyhow, the firstborn, very crucial in understanding how that functions. So as you look at this, of course, and by the way, just as an aside too, is significant because God in his sovereignty, if you look through the genealogies, God is forever picking the one who is not the firstborn, is he not? Time and time after time. Abraham was not the firstborn. You can tell by looking at the ages of those and when, you know, his father had the first child. You just keep going through this. Moses as well. You go to David. You go to Judah. You look at these various ones whom God chooses in his own way to show that his sovereign choice supersedes that. But anyhow, the firstborn, very crucial to them. And so as one mourns for the firstborn. Then notice in verse 11, in that day there will be great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the plain of Megiddo. What is that all about? What is this? He's describing the intensity of the mourning and trying to depict to these people what kind of mourning it will be. So first of all, the word itself, shows an intensity of mourning. The description as one mourns over the firstborn son shows an intensity of mourning. But this is now moving up even higher than that, a greater intensity of mourning. And what happened in the plains of Megiddo? Anybody? Anybody know what happens there? Josiah, the great beloved king of Israel, of Judah, actually. And after all of those kings that had not walked godly, he walked godly before God for many, many years. The king of Egypt is making his way north in battle. Josiah sees it to be his place to go out and withstand him. And the king of Egypt asks him not to do it. The last thing in the world he wanted to do was fight against Josiah. And Josiah dies, and Jeremiah describes the bitter, bitter mourning over the death of Josiah by the people of Judah. An incredible, intense time probably the most sorrowful time for Israel in their history in one sense. And so therefore, as he depicts this for them, they understand this. And so how he describes it. And what he is trying to do in all of this is to show the intensity of the mourning that's going to come in the future day when God's spirit of grace and supplication comes on Israel and they begin to realize that this is the one whom they have pierced. But now notice verse 12 to 14. And the land will mourn, every family by itself. Now, that's the overall statement. Anything that, in fact, you'll notice it starts every family by itself in verse 12. Go down to verse 14. All the families remain every family by itself. Now, if there's any point, that's the point. That is the whole point. All of this is just illustrative. The family of the house of David by itself and their wives by themselves. The family of the house of Nathan by itself and their wives by themselves. The family of the house of Levi by itself and their wives by themselves. The family of the house of Shemites by itself and their wives by themselves. All the families that remain, every family by itself and their wives by themselves. In other words, everybody. This is not going to be just something that is done representatively by one segment of the society of Israel in that day. Every family, the wives by themselves, the husbands by themselves, every family by itself, everybody is going to be touched with this spirit of grace and supplication, and they're going to weep over that which they have done to the Messiah. We go back again to the chapter that precedes this, chapter 11. What did they do? They sold him for 30 pieces of silver. And having sold him, they put him to the Romans, who therefore crucified him. And therefore, the end of this is an incredible thing, because then he brings it to this point and recognizes that there is a day coming. The greatest day for Israel will be the day of their cleansing. And so concludes chapter 12. Now, with this, I want you to move with me to chapter 13, because chapter 13 is but a continuation of what we have in chapter 12. We're not moving to something new, it's but a continuation of what we've seen, and you have the outline before you with one adjustment that I will make in there in a moment. But let me start out at the very beginning of this, because there is no doubt that chapter 13 is but a continuation of chapter 12, as we notice by the some of the statements we made. Let me put this up here for you again, just so that this is the very beginning of this, just some points to be made as we start this chapter, and it is a continuation, as we will see, of what we have just had in the previous section. This is the verse 1. Now notice, first of all, the very beginning in that day. Now, that you can't miss that, because we've seen that all the way through here. It starts in chapter 12. We've had that day all the way through that it is mentioned in that day. We're going to start out in verse 4 of chapter 12 in that day, verse 6 in that day, verse 8 in that day, many other references, but just some as highlight here, verse 11 in that day, chapter 13, verse 1 in that day. And again, we're going to see this in chapter 14, verse 4 in that day, and so forth. And so it's going to run down through this whole section that's in that day. But there is no doubt that what we have here, as we start this, there is going to be this in that day. There's going to be a fountain. Now, it's interesting, by the way, as we look at this and we sense that there's going to be a fountain, drawn in Cowper's song, there is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins. Now, just with me for a while. Do you see anything up here about blood in this fountain? Huh? See, when you think of fountain, what comes out of a fountain, and why does it come out of a fountain? What comes out of a fountain? Water. Well, what do you do with the water that comes out of a fountain? You drink it, and you do else with it. What else with it in this context? You wash with it, right? So really what this is not a fountain of blood, it's a fountain of water. We understand, and what he was tying together, which is true, he was tying this together with Calvary, and it is tied with Calvary. But the picture here is a picture of cleansing, and the picture of the water that comes to be used for cleansing and so forth. But anyhow, there will be a fountain. What is exciting, though, and again, we understand that it is, and we'll look at this together. But notice, and this really is the key to this whole section as we look at it, because there will be a fountain. And then notice this next part. And I start with these two words here. This right here. this word right here, and this word right here. Now, this is the word fountain in the middle here. This is this word up here, okay? So on the two sides over here, and you understand, we read this way, okay? So we start with this word first, which is right here, and it is the verb, the future of, okay? If I am, the future is I shall, right? And the future is it shall, okay? So therefore, that's the future tense of the verb to be. Are you with me just for a while? Hang in there with me. You see, this is nice, and for some back there, we're going to do this. See, this is what we call nifal, is a participle here. And what if some of you just I need to do this because some of these guys, you understand we talk about a periphrastic construction. Let me tell you what a periphrastic construction is. Just hang in there with me because this is good stuff. You understand that's, you remember when Taylor came out with what he called the paraphrased edition of the Bible, right? We have Living Letters, which is really a paraphrased edition. And what they do is it expanded translation to help make the idea clearer, right? So there are a whole bunch of these kinds of things in the New Testament and the Old Testament. But what he is saying here is very significant because there will continuously be a continuously open fountain. I mean, the incredible truth of this, and I only say this grammatical stuff to try to tell you, the point of this passage with this, what we call a periphrastic construction, is that there is going to continuously be a continuously open fountain for Israel. Which is an amazing truth because God is going to provide a continuous opportunity of cleansing for the nation. Now we know that when it all started from where? I mean, this is all based on what? It's all based on Calvary, isn't it, right? And what's interesting because the fountain will not be open till that day, but is the cleansing, huh? God has already made provision for the cleansing, but the cleansing isn't taking place nationally yet, nor will it take place nationally. Someone has said, you know, it is like what you would have if you had somewhere where you had a subterranean, you know, stream of water that nobody could access, but it was there, right? And all of a sudden one day it's going to be opened up, but it is there. And you know this fountain of cleansing goes back to Calvary, and that's why in Calvary's song there's a fountain filled with blood. But you see, let me say there is a fountain whose foundation is based on Calvary, if you will. But Calvary is where it all came from, and the provision was made at Calvary, but the actual experience of the cleansing of the nation is not going to be until some future date, and hopefully very soon. So as you look at this, anyhow, notice in that day, a fountain shall be continuously open. Now here we back to these two things again, which show us the relationship of the previous. For the house of David, Beth Dawid. But you know this is nice. You can do this, by the way, because that's where you get Bethlehem from, you see. It's nice. This is the, where are we here? If I can do it here, we go backwards here. This is the Beth right here, and this is Dawid right here. This is the house of David, and so therefore, and then this is the people who are the dwellers, for the dwellers of Jerusalem. Jerusalem. But anyhow, as you look at this, the house of David, and so in other words, the whole point of this is fountain, just as there will be a spirit of supplication for all of the inhabitants of Jerusalem and all of the house of David, everyone individually by himself, so this fountain will provide cleansing for all of the house of David and all the indwellers of Jerusalem. And the two things it's going to take care of, I mean, there's a whole bunch in here by itself, isn't there? First of all, for sin. Now, what's significant about this term for sin? Because I can tell you what it is, see. This word, we can start, this is an H right here, see? And it goes this way, right? Are you with me? This is an H, this is a T, this is an A. And what happens is if you put this thing, this is where we get the word to miss the mark. Those who have failed to reach the standard established by God. The next term is interesting because it has to do not with something that you, the word is from the verb flight, to flee from something, okay? And the next word, impurity, is from the word to flee. It's that kind of stuff that you flee from. Moral impurity. I mean, it just reminds us that 1 Timothy 6, you see, you know, Timothy, flee from these things, okay? So literally, the impurities are the things that one flees from, or the things that one should flee from, right? And in that day, God is going to take all of those things, the first word, all of those areas where Israel has missed the mark, if you will, and they have not lived up, when we've gone back to Romans, right? Fallen short of the glory of God, right? All of sin come short of the glory of God. We've missed the mark. We have not lived up to the standard we should. And the second word, all of those things from which one ought to flee, the impure things, God is going to take that fountain to make provision for all. I got to tell you, I don't know how excited you get, but chapter 13, verse 1 is an exciting verse for me just all by itself. We have to move on, but that's this exciting verse. Okay, so in that day, and just understand the provisions were all made at Calvary. I'll go back to that song this morning, see? It is all back there, right? All because of Calvary. And you see, all the provisions were made at Calvary, but you see, and the provision is there, but it will not be made available to Israel as a nation until a future day when God gives to them this spirit of grace and supplication, and God opens this fountain. And in that day, that fountain that has its root in Calvary and on Golgotha will be the means of the cleansing for all of Israel. Amazing, amazing, amazing. All right, now, let's go, if you will, with this in mind, okay? Having said that, now he is going to give us then the further illustration of this in chapter 13. So let's look in verse 2. It will come about in that day again. Notice, in that day declares the Lord of hosts, so I love this term, that I will cut off the names of the idols from the land, and they will no longer be remembered. I will also remove the prophets and the unclean spirit from the land. Come about that if anyone still prophesies, then his father and mother gave birth to him, will say to him, you shall not live, for you have spoken falsely in the name of the Lord. And his father and mother who gave birth to him will pierce him through when he prophesies. Now, that's going to be some kind of day. You tell you what, it's not going to be church discipline, it's going to be family discipline. And if a son is falsely prophesying, you know, so it's interesting, right? Some child sins today, and so often the parents, they come up there, you know, oh, my poor child, you know, whatever like this. Right? But that day, it's going to be a poor child, all right? Because if a child prophesies falsely, so much is God going to give a spirit of cleansing and regeneration, renewing, that even those who gave birth to this child are going to pierce him through. If he prophesies falsely and not in the name of God. And also, it will come about in that day that the prophets themselves will each be ashamed of his vision when he prophesies, and they will not put on a hairy robe in order to deceive. See, what's going to happen, this is all about the false prophets. And by the way, I made a mistake in the outline. I'll show you that in a moment. But it's interesting. This is all about the false prophets. And what's happening in that day, you see, in this day, guys are getting up and saying all kinds of outlandish things, and people believe them and buy into this stuff and support them. And that day it's not going to happen, and these false prophets will be so embarrassed by that which they do, which is against God, that they're not even going to put on the garments of a prophet. Now, in this day, they're not going to put on a backward collar, whatever in the world is. In that day, they wore hairy garments. That was the way they indicate that they were prophets. And they're not going to put on these things because they don't want anybody to know what they are. They will be embarrassed about the falsity that they are teaching. That's going to be a nice day, the day of cleansing for Israel. But now notice, and he will say, I'm not a prophet. You know, you're going to say, you know, you're a prophet. And you'll be like Peter, right? I am not a prophet. I'm a tiller of the ground. I'm a farmer, you see. And the whole issue of this from the very beginning, not only will people be embarrassed about false prophecy, false prophets will be embarrassed about their own occupation. Now, verse 6, I mistakenly, and I did that because it is one view, and it is, in my mind, there's a lot of debate on this, but I tell you where I'm landing, and I'm not landing where the notes are, so pardon me for that. I did this and forgot to correct myself, so that's just how it is. One of the views is That it says here, one will say, what are these wounds between your arms? And again, it could be between your hands. And he will say, these are which I was wounded at the house of my friends. Now, there are very good scholars. By the way, I got through the message this morning and somebody came up and said, in my Bible, it says there are three different views on this passage you just preached today. And I said, well, that's all right. I told you the right one. But anyhow, in this passage here, there are some very, very good men, okay, which I even reflected here, who think this is the Messiah. Okay. What is this wound in your hands? And he says, I got it in the hands of my lovers or my friends. In other words, he came unto his own received him not, and so forth. It is good arguments for it, you know, and it's not bad to hold to that. You've got Merrill Unger's in heaven and knows better now, but that's what he held to, okay? Or either that or Dr. Feinberg's there and finds out that he's not right, but I think he's right. I think that this is still the continuation of the false prophet of the section before. What are these wounds between your arms? Now let me tell you. Let me give you the point of this. Okay, go back with me in your mind since we had mention of Elijah earlier. You remember when Elijah went up on the mountain? Remember when he brought the prophets of Baal? And remember when he says, you know, cry out to your gods and do all this kind of stuff, right? And so, what did they do when, in fact, their gods weren't hearing what they were saying? What did they start to do? They started to cut themselves, right? Trying somehow to appease the God, to cause the God to do this kind of thing, or the gods, whatever they may be. And someone's going to see these wounds on their chest between their arms, because we're always talking here about false prophets, okay? People will not abide false prophets. False prophets will not be proud of what they do, because, why? Because they know they're going to die if they get found out. So they're not going to wear the garments of a prophet, and someone says, ah, but what are these marks on you? And they say, oh, well, you see, these, you see. And they're going to do is excuse these things, because there's no way they will ever admit that they got these, because they were cutting themselves to appease the gods. My thinking of that, and again, now the other view is that this is the Messiah. You can either way, it'll work, but it really doesn't matter in the context in one sense, although I think that is just the whole issue of, you know, the point of verses 2 to 6. Let's just understand the point, no matter how else one looks at this, is this. This is a great day because God is going to bring such a spirit of cleansing to the land. I love this. That people are not going to abide false doctrine. They're not going to listen to it. A father and mother will kill their own child who dishonors the word of God by teaching what's wrong in that day. That's an amazing statement. And those who are teaching what's wrong will not be as they are. I mean, they can go out there and say stuff today and nobody takes issue with them. Well, in the main, nobody takes issue with them. But in that day, it's not going to happen. Now, so that's the first result, okay? If you will, idolatry is exterminated, and go from 2 to 6 and cross out that 3B business, okay? Now, here we come. Now we come to this next part of this, which is a significant part because, as you note, let's find the outline for us here. The prelude to Israel's national cleansing, the sheep are, well, let's start, the provision for Israel's national cleansing. And here at this point, and that's why some would feel that we make the transition here to the Messiah in verse 6, but I think the transition to the Messiah is made in verse 7. But anyhow, Dr. Unger likes verse 6, Dr. Feinberg likes verse 7, and hey, I'm going to stick with the man. He got me there, so that's where it is. It's in verse 7. So here we start with verse 7, the provision for Israel's national cleansing. Now, as you look at this, it's very significant because all of this is tying in with what preceded. And really, this gives us the foundation for the fountain that is available for cleansing for Israel and for all the cleansing that God's going to provide. So it starts in verse 7 and says, awake. It awakens the sword. And again, the sword is the implement for taking a life. It is not, again, so crucial as to whether, you know, the instrument used so much as to the death that it produces. The means of it is awake, O sword, against my shepherd. And against the man, my associate. Now, it's interesting because, let me just read some of the statements that are made here, because listen to this. One of them, a man, my nearest relation. Another says, a man co-equal with me. Another, Arnheim, a Jew, says, the Jew says, the man whom I have associated myself with. Someone equal with the Lord of hosts. Who is equal with God himself, the Lord of hosts? It is the Messiah. It is the Lord Jesus Christ. And so this is God speaking, awake, O sword, against my shepherd. And again, the shepherd is the shepherd that came in chapter 11 to be offered to Israel, whom they rejected. He came unto his own received him not. And if you're going to take a comparable thing, this is to be equated with John 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This is an evidence of the deity of the Messiah. And so he is one who is God's shepherd. He is one who is God's associate, God's equal, if you will, declares the Lord of hosts. So whomever this my shepherd is, my associate is one who is equal with the Lord of hosts and who is his shepherd who is sent. Now notice what happens. So the provision of Israel here is, certainly the provision is the death of the shepherd, the striking of it. But now notice the warning that is here as you look at this, the prelude to this, if we look at this for a bit, you'll notice that the sheep are scattered. Strike the shepherd that the sheep may be scattered. Well, we know what happened there, do we not? And I will turn my hands against the little ones. It will be about, let me just go through the whole thing and we'll come back, and because we're not going to make it through all tonight, but it will come about in all the land, declares the Lord, the two parts in it will be cut off and perish, but a third will be left in it, which we called. You see, God is going to always keep his remnant. And I will bring this third part through the fire, refine them as silver is refined, test them as gold is tested. They will call on my name and I will answer them. And I will say to them, they are my people, and they will say, the Lord is my God. Just quickly, go through your notes just with me, the outline that you have, and we'll do that just quickly. Look at that way. And just follow. Let me just quickly take you that way. Notice the prelude. The sheep are scattered. The faithful sheep are warned, the next part of verse 17. And then notice the great tribulation, deliverance of the remnant, verses 8 and 9. It will come about that day. Two-thirds will be cut off. And this is the whole book of Revelation, which is partly why we came here to look at Zechariah just after doing Revelation, because there's so much tied to that. And if you're going to equate this with anything, you equate this with the time when the beast and the false prophet and Satan himself rise up and they go against Israel. And when they cannot get Israel, they go against the Messiah. When they can't get they go against the Messiah, then they go against Israel. When they can't get Israel, they go against the 144,000, and then they go against the witnesses. Notice the provision for Israel's cleansing in verse 9. The remnant calls. It's how it has to be. See, it is interesting. They will call on my name. Notice the response. I will answer them. They will say, and I will say, they are my people, and they will say, the Lord is. Or if you will, notice the Lord is a capital L, small capital O-R-D. Adonai Jehovah is our God. It is a great chapter. What's more important for Israel than the physical deliverance is the spiritual deliverance. And for us as well. It just is. I think I just assessing something as you listen to prayers, as I reassess my own prayers, is understand that the spiritual fulfillment of our needs is far more crucial than the physical fulfillments of our needs. I just think as I sit in a prayer meeting, one of them, I keep hearing the responses, and not here, okay, so just relax. I keep hearing response after response from godly people, but it's all about the physical things that are being done. Far more important than Israel's physical deliverance is a spiritual deliverance. And that's why all of this in chapters 12 and 13, it gives the physical deliverance, but it goes on to talk about what's far more crucial, the spiritual deliverance. And the beautiful part is that God's going to touch every family from the least to the greatest. God is going to cause everybody to have a spirit of repentance before God. God's going to transform the nation. God's going to cause people to turn against all false teaching. God's going to cause false teachers to be embarrassed by what they teach and therefore not admit that they're teaching it. And then God's going to, kind of how God's going to do it is all this last statement, because the shepherd's going to come, is going to be cut off. The sheep are going to be scattered because of it. But then God's going to come back and he's going to restore them as a nation. And he will one day say to them, "You are my people." And they will say to him, "You are our God." It is not now. Tis not now. We, the ones that God has grafted in, to the tree for a while, we are the ones who say this now. But one day Israel as a nation will say it, and it's a glorious day to look forward to. And we pray for that day and hope that it will. I just think of that song, "Soon and Very Soon," right? We trust that it will be, that this will happen. Exciting, is it not, right? "In that day a fountain shall stand opened." All right. Prayer request for us tonight. One of the things is, prayer request, what? He says to pray for what? The peace of Jerusalem. And we should be doing that as a regular basis. Pray this week. There's a meeting taking place in Moscow. Dr. Provost is there, and they're discussing the future of the school where Doug and Steve are working. And it's just, whatever they decide is going to affect what Doug and Steve do. So just pray for that. And Doug has sent some information to them to consider, and they will consider it and come back to them. And then the prayer request will be to enable these guys to be able to adjust to whatever the Baptist Union asks for. It doesn't look like the building is in. It's sort of out again. It's one of those things, if they ever get into the building, it will be a major work of God. But anyhow, so the building was almost there, 2 weeks ago, tomorrow, but now the building is not on, and whatever. So they're still quite a ways away from where they were. So pray for them during this week, and just pray for God's wisdom and God's direction, especially for Doug as he deals with some of those situations. Pray for Frank and Barbara as they return on Wednesday, and for God's strength for them. Other prayer requests, Bill, you know, we've prayed for you this last week, and God is, I think, slowly raising the family up to health again, right? Doing better, okay. We're not there, but we're doing better, okay. All right. What else can we pray for? Yes.
I talked to Martha this morning. She had asked for prayer because she has to go in for a test this week.